Molt bon dia a tothom. Good morning, everybody. First of all, we would like to welcome Professor Wilkinson and to thank him for being here today. Thank you for accepting our invitation. And also, we would like to thank all participants to be here in this conference, Inequality and Health. This conference, which has been organized by the Health Promotion Chair and the Ferreter I Mora Chair, with the collaboration of the Medical Science Department of the University of Girona, aims at emphasizing health inequalities, an actual issue which most health programs and policies are based on. Dr. Wilkinson is Professor Emeritus of Social Epidemiology at the University of Nottingham. He is also an Honorary Professor of Epidemiology and Public Health at University College of London and Visiting Professor at University of York. In 2009, co-founded the Equality Trust. He has been honored with several awards and published many scientific papers and reference books. Today, we know that 70% of illness are due to social environmental reasons, and that 40% of health-related issues can be explained from the health determinants factors and the political agenda. This data shows us that we should face a new model that leaves the classical risk factor health model and move forward to a health promotion-based model that emphasizes salutogenic factors and social health determinants. From the Health Promotion Chair of the University of Girona, our aims consist of focusing on health promotion studies, training and dissemination by organizing activities, networking and scientific promotion actions, both at a national and international level. This session today is a good example of it. We are sure that this conference today makes us be more aware about the relationship between the social health determinants factors and health, in order to help us to understand health inequalities. Thank you all being here and enjoy the conference. And below, Dr. Guillermo Pérez will introduce the conference. Thanks.
Thank you, Dolores. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Inequalities is the biggest threat to the world. That is how Danny Dolin, a friend and a colleague of Professor Wilkinson, frames the problem. I am very exactly and deeply thankful to have Richard Wilkinson among us today. We also have very special speakers for the afternoon session, and I would really like to thank the organization and collaborators to helping us put this event together. We invited Professor Wilkinson today to give you the opportunity to hear about firsthand how disruptive and can be health to social issues and can be social issues to health and social issues at large. Sorry. We will listen to him for about an hour or so, and then we will have about 40 minutes for questions. Professor Wilkinson, together with his wife, Professor Kate Pickett, are world authorities on health inequalities. The first time I read about Professor Wilkinson was a work in an article entitled "Is Capitalism a Disease?" by Richard Levin. Soon after the Speeded Level came out, the evidence and arguments in this book were so compelling that I asked myself, how come we are not teaching this to our students? Well, it turns out that there are few efforts to teach about inequalities in some curricula. I think Dulos and the nursing school are good examples of them. And our school is also gradually picking the idea. For instance, last year, I had the opportunity to propose an elective subject in the School of Medicine. where I teach other classes as well. Fortunately, my proposal was accepted, and last year we have our first course. We were thankful to come with the participation of Joan Benac and Teresa Furcada Sibila, who are here in the audience today. Last year, we could not bring Professor Wilkinson because of the short notice and his tight schedule. But since he showed his will to collaborate with us in the future, we decided to try again for this academic year. And thanks to the effort of several people, especially Professor Wilkinson himself, we have this wonderful meeting today. Nowadays, learning about inequalities is not only relevant for health students. We believe it's a critical issue for the entire society, for the entire university rather, and for society as a whole. Once again, an old specter is haunting Europe and the entire world. But far from carrying an apocalyptic message, Professor Wilkinson delivers an awakening call that reinstates individual worth and people's hope. Please join me in welcoming Professor Richard Wilkinson.
Apologize for not speaking Spanish. Yes. Or Catalan. My language is a great weakness, and we English are always privileged because so many other people speaking English as a second language. I want to start off really by explaining that I think that the effects of inequality have been really misunderstood. The naive view of inequality is that it matters only because it means some people have poorer material conditions. So all the problems of poverty people understand in terms of what your material environment does to you. I want to talk about the psychosocial effects of inequality. And I'm going to start by reading a quote from a paper in the Journal of Social Policy. It's a paper in which they examine people's experience of poverty. Am I holding this at the right distance for you to hear at the back easily?
Yes.
Good. They interviewed people, poor people, in a number of different countries about the experience of poverty, what it meant to them. So they talked to people, poor people in rural Uganda, in India, in urban areas of China, in Pakistan, in Korea, in Britain, and in Norway. And if you think of the material conditions of the poor, the people considered as poor in those different countries, in India, they would be living in little shacks with an earth floor, with no running water, no sewerage, very insanitary conditions. In Norway, they would have three-bedroomed houses with central heating, a flat-screen television, and yet still be regarded as poor in relation to the Norwegian scale of income. And this is the summary of what poor people in those different countries said about their experience of poverty. Respondents universally despised poverty and frequently despised themselves for being poor. Parents were often despised by their children, women despised their menfolk, and some men were reported to take out their self-loathing on their partners and children. Despite respondents generally believing that they had done their best against all odds, they mostly considered that they had both failed themselves by being poor and that others saw them as failures. This internalization of shame was further externally reinforced in the family, the workplace, and in dealings with officialdom. Even children couldn't escape this shaming, for with the possible exception of Pakistan, school was an engine of social grading, a place of humiliation for those without the possessions that guaranteed social acceptance. No parent was able to escape the shame of failing to provide for their children, Even when children were prepared to stop asking for the things, the latter itself being a further source of shame. For men, relying on others or on the welfare benefits was perceived as a challenge to their sense of masculinity. A British father of two children admitted that, "I feel like shit. I'm the man in this relationship. I'm meant to be the man, to take care of the missus and my kids, and I don't." So you see that despite very different material conditions, being at the bottom of society has these extraordinarily powerful psychosocial consequences on how you feel about yourself, how you feel others see you. And it's that really that I want to talk about. And in relation to health, of course, this experience of shame and humiliation is a very powerful stressor. And stress affects host resistance. It makes us more vulnerable to all sorts of diseases. This is just a little graph which shows, it's from a Swedish research paper. These bars, the light blue, are people with reduced psychosocial well-being. And the dark blue bars are long-term illness and depression. And they're ranged by how many times people felt shamed in the last 3 months. So these ones hadn't been shamed at all. And what is it, around 5% of them had either those conditions, and it goes up to, this one, what is that, about 38%, and that up to 55 or 60%. So huge difference in these psychosocial problems according to how often they had that experience of feeling shamed. This is, as I said, a very powerful source of stress and anxiety, and we know how stress relates to death rates. This is the General Health Questionnaire measure of stress, and this is relative risk of death. And the people with the lowest levels of stress, their relative risk is 1. And you see, even the very first increases in stress, you get small increases in mortality, in death rates. And we now know that chronic stress looks rather like more rapid aging. We know quite a lot about how it affects the immune system, the cardiovascular system, and very many other physiological processes. So, you know, that is, I think, how it feeds into health in a nutshell. What I'm going to talk about is really this little diagram again and again, with income inequality along the bottom and different problems up the side, sometimes poor health, sometimes violence, sometimes teenage births, sometimes child well-being. And all the problems increase with more income inequality. I want to make the same point that it's about relative standards, not about absolute material conditions in the rich world, just in statistical terms. So here you've got life expectancy at birth in relation to gross domestic product per capita, where countries are in the long process of economic growth. And you see the rapid rises in life expectancy in the early stages of economic growth, and then it levels out. So all the rich countries up here, I'm sorry that Spain isn't marked with a label there, but it's one of those dots. It is on my own version of this, but my own version is out of date, so I downloaded this one that somebody else drew. But the point is that this is not a ceiling effect. It's not that 80 years is the limit of human life expectancy. We still get another 2 or 3 years life expectancy with every 10 years that passes. But it's no longer in the rich world related to economic growth. Even when you look at change over 10, 20 or 40 year periods, you find almost no relationship between economic growth and changes in life expectancy. what happens is that this curve moves up over time. So it used to be down here. And so even if you're stuck on a gross domestic product, say of $30,000 per capita, you still get these increases in life expectancy. What's important, though, is that you get the same sort of pattern if you look at other measures of well-being, like happiness. That early economic growth matters and later it doesn't. Basically, what this is telling us is that there are diminishing returns in the economic, using an economic expression, to increased increased income. So it's really important for people in poorer countries to have higher material standards. But for us in the rich world, to have more and more of everything makes less and less difference. But what I really wanted to show you is, well, first I'm going to concentrate on those rich countries, and here's the data for them. As this is one of our graphs, Spain is there. Where is it? Yes, here. Sorry. I was expecting it to be here, because in our inequality graphs it's nearly always in the middle. But the point of this is just to show you that some countries can be twice as rich as others in the developed world, and it makes absolutely no difference to life expectancy. So material standards, when you compare different developed countries, it doesn't help to have more economic growth. But within countries, you get these extraordinary social gradients in health. You all know where health is worst in Barcelona. You probably find quite big differences in life expectancy between rich and poor areas. In the most unequal countries like Britain and the United States, often you will find in the same city 5, 10, or even 15-year differences in life expectancy between the poor and the richest areas of the same city. But you see, this is not a... I should explain. These are small areas, neighbourhoods, and the poorest ones with the short life expectancy are there, and the richest ones with the long life expectancy. This is quite old data, but it shows the gradient so beautifully clearly. It shows you that it's not just the difference between the poor and everyone else. To understand health inequalities, it's no good thinking just about the unemployed or the homeless. We're all part of this picture. Michael Marmot sometimes says that you can take away all the problem of poverty and poor health, and you've still got most of the pattern of health inequalities left. You have to have a quite different theory to understand this. Your theory needs to explain why the people just below the top do less well than the people at the top. But you see, there's a paradox here. Income between countries didn't matter at all. But income, or something like it, within countries is very important. And I think that's because here we're looking at the effects of relative income, of social status, of where we are in relation to each other. So again, it's about the psychosocial effects of social status, social position. And that's how it fits in with the reading I gave you earlier. I think behind all this are our evolved sensitivity, in terms of our evolved psychology, sensitivity to social status issues. For evolutionary reasons that are very clear, in terms of if you think of monkeys in a dominance hierarchy, the top get the access to all the necessities, food, comfortable places to sleep in the shade, reproductive access. All that kind of thing, dominants do much better than subordinates. And so I think we have this inherited sensitivity. We also need different social strategies depending on where you are in the hierarchy. So even amongst monkeys, there's evidence of more risk-taking amongst subordinate animals than dominants. Subordinates have to take risks. There's no point in delaying gratification. If something is available now, you take it. But as soon as you've got that contrast between, well, as soon as you recognize that we're really dealing with, in the rich world, with relativities, you must start thinking, what happens if we make the differences between us larger or smaller? And we're able to examine that by comparing income differences in different countries. So when we were writing our book, gathering data from the UN Human Development website, but it's the same data as the World Bank had, this measure of income inequality, how much richer are the top 20% than the bottom 20%, in Japan, Finland, Norway, and Sweden, the top 20% are 3.5 or 4 times as rich as the bottom 20%. But in the more unequal countries, UK, Portugal, USA, Singapore, the gap is twice as big. Now, Spain, as I said, was around about the middle. This data is, I think, 2003 or 2004. Since then, you've become more unequal, so you've moved a bit in the wrong direction. And Portugal has moved this one. It's become more equal, while you've become less equal. So, what we did was collect international comparable data. We never compiled our own data, we just downloaded what WHO had, or OECD, what various international organizations had, the data for these different countries on life expectancy, the OECD data on children's maths and literacy scores, on infant mortality rates, homicide rates, the proportion of the population in prison, teenage birth rates, how much people feel they can trust others, that's a measure of social cohesion, obesity rates, mental illness, which these are WHO figures, which because it's the standard psychiatric classification of mental illness, it includes drug and alcohol addiction as mental illnesses, and some figures on social mobility. We put them all together in one index, our index of health and social problems. They're all weighted equally, so here they are. And so where a country is its sort of average score on these things. It's influenced just as much by life expectancy as by children's maths and literacy scores. And you see the more unequal countries doing worse, USA, Portugal, UK. Problems worst in all of those, and best in Norway, Sweden, Japan. Spain, right in the middle. You'll find in all the ones with income inequality, Spain is in the middle. I should remind you it's moved in the wrong direction. And Portugal, exactly where we'd expect it, but it's moved the other way. And if you look at this same index in relation to gross national income per head, those problems are not helped at all by further economic growth. We also looked at the UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing. We did a paper in the British Medical Journal looking at the UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing, and it has 40 different components. So whether children feel they can talk to their parents easily, whether there is bullying at school, how they do in these maths and literacy tests, what immunisation rates are like, all those kinds of things go into the UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing, and it's unrelated to gross national income per head. But here it is related to income inequality, and you see children in the more unequal countries doing so much less well. It's always the same countries down at that end, always the same ones up here. UNICEF produced a new index 10 years later, and we looked at changes in income inequality and changes child well-being. And it's a wide scatter, but it's statistically significant. Even over 10 years, you can see the effects of rising income inequality or falling income inequality affecting all those different measures of child well-being. Interestingly, Sweden has had widening income differences. It was very egalitarian, but it's been moving in the wrong direction, and you can see the effects on child well-being. This is the measure of trust. It comes from the World Value Survey. It's the proportion of the population, the percent of the population, who agree that most people can be trusted. It's a rather general question. It's used again and again in surveys. In the American General Social Survey, they try several different questions about trusting others, and they all produce similar results, showing that people trust each other less in more unequal places. The differences are big. And down that end, you've got 15 or 20% of the population who trust others, and up here it's 60 or 65% who trust others. If you have to walk home alone in one of the more unequal societies in a big city, you won't feel very safe. In the more equal societies, you will feel safe. There's now quite a lot of work on different measures of social cohesion, and they all seem to be closely related to inequality, for reasons I'll suggest later. We did all this work on these different countries, looking at it internationally, but we also repeated it for American states. So we took the 50 American states and asked again, do the more unequal American states with the bigger income differences do less well? And the picture is very similar. Here's that same measure of trust. The more unequal states, lower levels of trust. Quite a convincing, all these are statistically significant. These are teenage birth rates. Again, very big differences. These are births per 1,000 women in their teens, 15 to 19, and that would be about 5 per 1,000 women having babies in their teens. In the UK, we had 6 times that level. In the United States, 10 times that level. Spain, down here. This is drug use. Spain a bit higher than the regression line, but again, quite a scatter. The wider the scatter, the more more powerful other influences are. If inequality was the only thing to affect these outcomes, they'd all line up exactly on the line. But the fact that one end is higher than the other shows you the sort of average effect of inequality, in with all sorts of other unknown factors that affect each of these outcomes. So when I showed you that our index of health and social problems, that fit was so close, it was such a high statistical correlation, because when you put things together, life expectancy and levels of homicide and teenage births and so on, it tends to emphasize the common variants. The things that they have in common become the dominant factors when you put them together. This is prisoners per 100,000 population. This is a log scale. So Japan is a bit higher than you'd expect, about 40 prisoners per 100,000 population, and it goes up to about 400. So tenfold difference in homicide rates, and in the teenage birth rates. It was, if you include the United States, again, about a tenfold difference related to inequality. These are homicide rates. These red dots are American states. This is data from Martin Daly and Margot Wilson in Canada, and they put in the Canadian provinces as well. But, you know, this is homicides per million. That would be about 15 homicides per million, and it goes up to 150. 10 times the homicide rates in the more unequal states. So now, people sometimes, our critics suggest that almost that we invented all this. We very carefully selected the countries, very carefully selected the problems to suit our argument. In fact, the first papers, academic research papers, showing violence was related to inequality came out in the 1970s. There are now at least 60 of them. The same applies to the papers showing connections between inequality and life expectancy or other measures of death rates. And then we thought there were about 300 of them, but our colleagues at the Harvard School of Health say they think it's closer to 400. So there's a vast literature. What our book did was not really break new ground, it was just to present to the public the picture that had been coming together in the academic journals that nobody reads. Even academics read very few of these papers. I think the average readership of a paper is sometimes single figures. So I think I've shown you that you get, what's for this? I showed you declining trust, increasing violence, community life atrophying, weakening. But you see, what happens when you go to somewhere with very high income inequality? We were in Mexico early last year. Not only has community life broken down, but you actually defend yourself from other people. The houses have bars on the windows, these great fences round the razor wire round the top. So with more inequality, you move from a cohesive society in which, in the papers which show people are more helpful of each other, they're more willing to help old people or people with disabilities in more equal countries than more unequal countries. But you move from that strong community life to a situation where you defend yourself from each other. And this one, this picture is from South Africa where we were recently. You can't read this, but it says armed response. So if you try and climb over the fence, you'll get shot. Or you should be ready to be. And you see the big dogs there. Those wires on the top are electric wires. And again, you see this. This is some research that adds to that same picture from two American researchers. They published this. I rather congratulate them on publishing it in the New York Times because it's so important that academic work gets into the, so the public see it. And what they've done here is they show that the proportion of the labor force occupied in what they call guard labor increases with inequality. By guard labor they mean security staff, police, prison officers, all that kind of thing. The part of the labor force that defends people against other people. So a different measure of inequality, they used the Gini coefficient, the percent of the, it's the rate, the protective services, that guard labor, employees per 10,000 workers going up. This is 50, that's 150, and America now has got to around 200 per 100,000. So this rather clear picture. I don't think I've got. No, I. Yes, I did. Did I show you the? Sorry, I do this so often. I forget what I've shown. Did I show you the one of prisoners per head of population? That relationship is not based on more crime. It's not a reflection of more crime in more unequal societies. Some of it is that, but most of it is more punitive sentencing. You send people to prison for smaller offences, you send them to prison for longer. That's the main, most important reason why more people are in prison in more unequal countries. We also find, if you look at the age of criminal responsibility of children, the law treats children as adult criminals at a younger age in more unequal countries. The American states that retain the death penalty, they don't divide up perfectly between more and less equal states, but predominantly the ones that retain the death penalty are the more unequal states. So the whole quality of social relations deteriorates with inequality. As I believe a number of you, many of you are medical students, I thought I'd show you this graph, American states and Canadian provinces, income inequality and death rates per 100,000 population. This is the, it's amongst men and men of working age that you see the closest relationships. There are close relationships with infant mortality. Women's mortality is also related to inequality, but this is where it's closest. However, the correlations between current mortality and current inequality are strongest at younger ages. This is naught, so at birth, and this is people over 64, and this is the correlation with, well, it's the regression coefficient against the Gini coefficient of inequality. So what it shows you is there's a stronger correlation between current inequality and current death rates at younger ages, and it pretty well disappears amongst the old. Health inequalities are smaller amongst the old too. I didn't know at all whether this was because somehow the old people are immune from the effects of social status differences and inequality, or whether maybe they are being affected by earlier experience of inequality. We know that social status at birth, at early adulthood and middle age are all significant influences on health of people my age, but we didn't know quite why there was so little correlation between current inequality and current death rates. And of course, over time, fewer and fewer deaths have been happening here. They've all been shifting to old age. So the correlation has weakened. If you look at correlations with life expectancy, it's weakened since I started working on this. But we now know that there are quite long lag times between changes in inequality and changes in death rate. Work on whole population death rates show that after a rise in inequality, the effects come through to health about 3 years later and go on coming through. This is marginal changes in mortality. And they have accumulated by about 12 years later. So it's not instantaneous. And actually, there's been another more recent paper that shows that early life experience of inequality affects health in later life as well. And presumably it differs not only by age group, but also by cause of death. Some causes are quite immediate, like homicide, and others have other diseases, had long histories. People often think it's so extraordinary that so many different outcomes, totally different kinds of outcomes, are all related to inequality. You know, the people who do research on drug abuse are quite different from people who do research on school performance of children, or looking at homicide or health. What all these problems have in common is that they all have social gradients. You know, there is violence at the top of society and mental illness and physical illness, but they're all more common at the bottom. And it's those kinds of problems which become so much more common in more unequal societies. Just to show you a few of the statistics, when we're looking at countries, the international correlations, we use the UN Human Development Report inequality data, and you see the regression coefficients here for each of these problems, and the p-values. If you look at the Gini coefficient provided by OECD, they're slightly weaker, mainly because OECD thinks that Japan isn't as equal as the UN thinks it is. A group of British and Japanese researchers got together to try and make a good, really sound comparison between Japanese inequality and British inequality, and found that actually Japan is still near the Scandinavian countries. So it looks as if OECD don't have their figures quite right. Amongst the American states, those are the correlations. So, you know, it doesn't matter too much what measure or what source the data comes from. You tend to find these relationships. However, we are now in a period of rapidly changing inequality in many countries, and given that there are lag times, you can't always be sure you'll find relationships between current inequality and current levels of particular problem. I think what we're talking about is not something independent of the effects of social class and social status. What it does is make the effects of class and status more powerful determinants of how we all do in society. We've had even conservative politicians in Britain say that they want to create a classless society. But they talked about that thinking that income inequality and wealth inequality didn't matter at all. But the point I want to make is that the material differences are the foundations of the forms of social distance, the social distinctions, the different ways of life that upper and lower classes live. And if you read sociologists like Bourdieu, you know, they talk about how people use income to express their social status, to create and express social distinctions. So I think it's a matter of whether we live in a society with a very steep social pyramid like this, or a much shallower one like that. oh yes, these are actually the two references to looking at the lag periods between inequality and changes in health. Last of these very simple graphs, I think it's the last. Sometimes people say, well, inequality is fair if people can find their right level in society. If you work hard, you get up, and if you don't, you go down. That's the common view. But actually, it looks as if where income differences are bigger, there is less social mobility. The system becomes more rigid. So if you're born poor, you're more likely to stay poor. If you're born rich, you stay rich. The measure of social mobility is the correlation between fathers' and sons' incomes. I'm sorry, it's not mothers and daughters. The people who produce this data and they couldn't do mothers and daughters because there are such big changes in women's activity rates over the generations. I've been pointing out how big the differences are. You know, sometimes tenfold differences in imprisonment, in homicide, in teenage births, because that in itself tells you that these problems, that inequality doesn't just affect the poor. If inequality just affected the poor, the poor couldn't drive such huge differences in population averages. The differences are big because we are all affected. Just as I showed you earlier on in those the blue bars, the light blue bars, that even the people just below the top do less well than the people at the top. So changes in inequality affect that gradient. And they not only they make a big difference to the people at the bottom, but even at the top, greater equality seems to have some small benefits. This is a paper from Banks and Marmot, where they compare American white population. They left out the black population because they didn't want people to say, well, this isn't inequality, it's about race. So they just looked at the American white population and compared it with the British white population. Here they looked at different diseases, diabetes, hypertension, cancer, lung disease, and heart disease. In this graph, they're classified by the proportion of in the bottom third educationally, the middle third by education, and the most highly educated third. And you see in all these, the British figures, the England, is the morbidity rates are lower than in the USA, but they're lower not just amongst the poorest educated, but amongst all of them, right across. And you see that, and this is basically the same story. This is literacy scores rather than morbidity, and it's by parents' education. So up here you've got the children's literacy scores of very well-educated parents. These parents have had 14, 15, 16 years of education. These are their children in Sweden, Canada, and United States. And you see, if your parents are badly educated, you're nearer the bottom of society, it makes a huge difference which country you're in. But even if you're at the top, you do a little bit better to be in Sweden than in the United States. And that's, we've now got quite a bit of data suggesting this is the most common pattern, that inequality has its biggest effects at the bottom, but we're all affected by it. The better off of the effects are smallest. One way in which you can see very clearly our sensitivities to social status is from what are called stereotype threat experiments that psychologists sometimes do. This one was reported in the World Bank World Development Report some years ago. They asked Indian children from different castes, high and low caste Indian children, to do some pen and paper tests. They do them under two conditions, one where they don't know each other's caste, and you see the low caste children here do just as well as the high caste children. But when they do know each other's caste, the low caste children do much less well. And that's been repeated on black and white populations in the United States, on high and low class populations in Europe. You can also see it in gender studies. Any little subtle reminder in the experimental situation that you belong to a group whose performance is thought to be inferior, the common social prejudice that people like you in your category do less well, it affects performance. Now I want to get more into the explanations of what's going on behind this data. When we started realizing that stress was an important factor affecting host resistance to disease and hastening, well, leading to more rapid aging, psychologists around the world started doing experiments on physiological responses to doing stressful tasks. Hundreds of experiments were done where you invite students into the laboratory and you get them to do something stressful while measuring their cortisol responses in saliva or blood or whatever. And in a review study, they looked to see what kind of stressful tasks most reliably push up cortisol. And if I ask you to do mathematical problems, will that push up your cortisol? If I ask you to what your marks are, and you have to say you only got 5 out of 10 and everyone thinks you're not very good, is that stressful? If you have to write about an unpleasant experience, so your mind is turning over what happened to you, or if you're videoed while you're doing something, or have to talk to other people in the group about some issue. So they use lots of different stressors. And in this paper, they look at 208 studies like that. And they ask what kind of stressors most reliably pushed up cortisol levels. And they say it was tasks with social evaluative threat. They say threats to self-esteem or social status where others may negatively judge your performance. So what gets to us is our worries about how others judge us, our sensitivity to what we fear other people think of us. We worry about making fools of ourselves in front of other people. That seems to be one of the most powerful causes of stress when you're looking at populations. And of course there can be worse individual stressors. Losing your job or being sent to prison or whatever, losing your home, but most of us don't experience that kind of thing. We do all experience these. And actually, we now know that those issues to do with social status, you can see that how our worries about how we're seen and judged feed into social status issues. Are you looked up to and respected, or are you looked down on and disrespected? There was a very important paper by Sherry Johnson and other people in the States in the Psychological Bulletin on what they call the dominance behavioral system. If you like, a brain area that seems to handle social status issues. They go through vast amounts of evidence on personality disorders and mental illnesses, and they show a lot of evidence that quite a number of personality disorders and mental illnesses are related to issues around the effects of social status, whether you accept your inferiority or fight against it, or struggle for superiority or assume your superiority. You know, you get narcissistic personality disorders, you get psychoses and so on, depression, which are partly responses to these social pressures. But when Sherry Johnson did this paper, she just assumed that all societies basically were hierarchical. Hierarchy was an issue in all societies. What she didn't realize is that we were working on class and status and hierarchy being more powerful in more unequal societies. And gradually more evidence has been accumulating that some of the conditions she thought were related to hierarchy, your response to hierarchy, are more common in more unequal societies. So, and the first thing I'm going to show you is actually a study of status anxiety your worries about how you're seen and judged, your worries about status. On this axis, you have income deciles. So these are the poorest tenth of the population. Here are the people in the middle of society, and the richest tenth of the population there. And this top line is status anxiety in countries with very high income inequality. And the bottom line is countries with low inequality. So we all worry less about status if we're in a more equal society. Right across the income scale, not just the poor. And there are two responses to this. If we're all more worried about how we're seen and judged, and we're judging each other more by status, one response is to go in for a kind of self-advertisement, self-aggrandizement, or what they call self-enhancement. So here, this is an international team, and they asked people in these different countries, so they were national teams, I think, from these different countries, to rate themselves compared to what they felt was their national average. So do you think you're more intelligent than most people in Spain or Catalonia? Do you think you're more attractive? Do you think you're more generous? Do you think you're a better driver than other people? I think in some countries 90% of the population think they're better drivers than average. They put all that together and find in more unequal countries there's more that self-enhancement. We said in our book, The Spirit Level, that one of the costs of greater inequality was that people cease to be modest about their achievements and ability. You flaunt it, you find ways of communicating to people around you your achievements and cleverness and how much you earn, you're able to have holidays wherever it is and so on. That also feeds into conspicuous consumption. If you're worried about how you're seen and judged, you're more likely to try and wear status goods or have an iPhone or whatever it is. Several studies now showing that. Because money is how you express your status very often. But there's also another response. You not only flaunt your abilities and achievements, but at the bottom end, if you're worried about how you're seen and judged, you can be overcome with low self-esteem, lack of confidence, self-doubt and depression. And social contact becomes an ordeal. You just find other people, it's too stressful. You're always worried about their judgments and what they think of you. So some people don't like to go to the front door when the bell rings. People don't like, some people won't go to parties. You can also see, this is narcissism going up in the United States. It's suggestive that maybe it's reflecting the changes in income inequality. This is bullying. If I said that I think that it's about our evolved sensitivity to social status. Animal dominance hierarchies are bullying hierarchies. The chief baboon is the strongest and biggest, and the most subordinate is the weakest. And if there's any dispute about status, there's some trial of strength that sorts out who is dominant over others. So it's a bullying hierarchy. The dominants can get just about anything they want first, because other animals know there's no point in fighting over it. And although we don't have good measures of bullying amongst adults that are internationally comparable, we do amongst children. Bullying is much more common in more unequal societies This is the percent of 11-year-old children who bullied others more than twice or more in the last month. And you see down here, that's about 2.5% of them bullied others. Up there, it's 20%. So huge differences in how much bullying there is, reflecting this kind of change in society. I'm going to leave that out, but you know, I think it goes right down to the sort of self-doubt of this kind, particularly amongst young people, where you know, we all know these worries that we're not smart enough, we're not attractive enough, we're not good looking, we're not funny enough, we don't feel you're good at conversation, things like that. And of course, young people, perhaps girls before they go out in the evening, often in tears about what clothes to wear. So meeting others is really an ordeal. We think of it as a sort of private weakness, or maybe we think of it as a weakness that human beings suffer generally, but we don't realize that these self-doubts are much more common in more unequal societies. They're stronger in more unequal societies. And the response, of course, is that you have a few drinks before you go out. To really relax with your friends, you need to... People, well, at home in Britain, enormous amount of drunkenness on Friday and Saturday nights. That's how to relax with other people. And ecstasy, of course, is valued because it makes you feel at ease with others. And what that is meaning is that inequality gets into the most important aspects of the real quality of life. If you read studies of happiness, happiness is about the quality of your social relationships, a relationship with your partner, how many friends you have, how cohesive the society is, whether you're involved in wider social activities. All crucially important to friendship, sorry, to happiness. But also the studies of health. A meta-analysis of 150 studies of health and friendship showed that whether or not you have friends is at least as important, perhaps a little bit more important, than whether or not you smoke to survival in a follow-up period. These are not vague kind of things. It would be nice to think that social stuff matters. It's hard data. But inequality, that's exactly where it does its damage. I'm going to leave out this, I think. But, you know, the two different ways people can come together, either dominance hierarchies. You know, the difference between dominance hierarchies and friendship is that dominance hierarchies are about power, coercion, privileged access to resources, regardless of other people's needs. I come first. But friendship is exactly the opposite of that. It's about reciprocity, mutuality, sharing, a recognition of each other's needs. And even the word companion in European languages, it's about sharing the basic necessities. Your companions are the people with whom you share food. And this American anthropologist who worked on hunting and gathering societies, which are highly egalitarian, based on food sharing and gift exchange, he said, gifts make friends, and friends make gifts. Because the gift is the clearest symbol that I'm not going to fight you for access to whatever it is. I recognize your need and give it. And your sense of indebtedness, which some psychologists say is a human universal, which makes you willing to reciprocate the gift, Stalin says creates a social compact between people. So we always have the awful alternative
between fighting each other for everything because our needs are all roughly the same, or recognizing each other's needs and sharing. And which path you go down is influenced partly by the scale of inequality, the strength of social hierarchy in a society. And it looks as if these processes are so powerful that we even have epigenetic processes feeding into adaptation to these different kinds of social life. So for an early development in children, you know, is that child growing up in a society where it must fight for what it can get, learn not to trust others, be all the time on guard? Or is it growing up in a society where it must develop empathy, learn to trust other people, and be cooperative with others? Those need quite different emotional and cognitive development. And some of the epigenetic changes, the changes in gene expression, seem to be affected by subjective social experience early on. So feeding into these same processes. I think I've just about finished, except to show you this is what's been happening to Portuguese inequality. This goes from 2003 to 2012. This is Spain, slight rise. This is 2007, 2008, 2009. So there's the southern European countries plus Ireland. Internationally, from 1930 to 2015, you get inequality coming tumbling down from the 1930s until the late 1970s, and then the modern rise of inequality with neoliberalism. So all the progress in this period is basically reversed. Our societies become more antisocial as a result. And I think that this is a reflection of first the strengthening and then the weakening of the whole social democratic and organized labor, the countervailing voice, an alternative vision of how societies should work. And so that is a measure of income inequality in the United States, the same from 1918 to 2008. This is a measure of trade union strength in blue. So as societies, as unions got stronger, societies got more equal. I don't think it's simply that unions do wonderful things for their members. I think it's also that trade unions are a measure, if you like, of how strong that countervailing voice is in society, that different ideology. I'm going on much too long, so stop. There's a Spanish edition of our book, and we produced this pamphlet that you can download from the Fabian Society for free, but we also have the Equality Trust that campaigns on inequality. Thank you.